Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Saturday, November 6, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this afternoon is Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, writes for the New York Star Ledger, also writes for Masterworks Broadway, among many of his other projects. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is a chief theater critic for talkinbroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You're probably wondering why we're coming to you on this Saturday. It's because tomorrow is Sunday, the New York City Marathon, and I will be running.
Are you really?
No, I'm lying through my teeth. It's actually something that I'd like to do eventually, but really I can barely drive 26 miles, much less run one. But we want to wish good luck to Randy Meyer, who is running the New York City Marathon tomorrow. He is the former company manager for many Disney's show. He was with Mary Poppins, and now he's with Cirque du Soleil. And there's a handful of other Broadway folks that are running the New York City Marathon who I can't think of off the top of my head.
I think Kate Schindel regularly runs the
And she's she makes me sick. You know, talented, beautiful, and runs marathons. I'm so tired of her.
And was a Miss America.
And yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Not a bad credential.
Yeah. It pops out every now and then. People had mentioned, oh my goodness.
And a very lovely human being.
I second that.
Which is absolutely maybe most important of all.
Yeah, absolutely. So. I remember many, many years back attending a party in a friend's apartment on West 57th Street, and she walked in the room, and she's one of those people that just lights up a room. She's got that indescribable thing, that star quality that you just immediately know that she's a star. And, just sitting there in a t-shirt and jeans and hanging out at a party, and we're like, oh my goodness, that was Miss America. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And a wonderful person, as you mentioned, as well.
This story doesn't surprise me at all. I would fully expect that. She really is amazingly down to earth, and I wish her nothing but the best as the years continue.
All right. So this week, we are going to go off Broadway to start with In the Wake, written by Lisa Krohn. Matthew, why don't you start us in with that?
A lot of our listeners probably remember Lisa Krohn from Well. She wrote and starred in that play, which started at the Public Theater off Broadway in 2004 and then moved to Broadway very briefly, unfortunately, a couple of years later. And that was also the play that introduced Jane Houdyshell to the world. And Daniel Breaker, who went on to Passing Strange and Shrek, was also in the cast. And certainly it was certainly a wonderful play about a woman who has issues with her mother and issues with wellness and tries to tie them all up in a meta-theatrical tapestry that really is very funny and very touching. And it was a wonderful little play. But of course, that's really not what Lisa Krohn is best known for. I mean, she is generally considered a downtown sort of artist with heavy political leanings. And she's made no secret about her sexuality, and a lot of her plays deal with that. And so In the Wake really is kind of a quote unquote return to form for Lisa Krohn, in that it's about a young woman who's named Ellen and played by Maren Ireland, who is wonderful in general in a lot of shows, but really for me made her most lasting mark on Broadway in Reasons to Be Pretty by Neil LaBute. She has a long-term boyfriend / common-law husband, if they even still use that term, who's named Danny and played by Michael Chernus. And they live in East Village apartment, and she, over the course of the George W. Bush presidency, or a large portion of it, about 5 years, she rails. I mean, she's hardcore liberal and hates everything that George W. Bush does and stands for. But she has her own sort of moral issues that come out during that time that she has to deal with. And it's, for me, the interesting part of the play, the only interesting part of the play, really, is how she sort of deals with the contradictions that come up in the way she sees politics and in the way she conducts her life. Because she's always been sort of, the character of Ellen has always been sort of bisexual. And even though she lives with Danny and has very strong feelings for him, she falls for and conducts a long-term relationship on the side with a filmmaker whom she meets in Boston, who she knew when she was younger. It's a sister of a friend of hers. And they sort of get together, and eventually that relationship becomes so serious that Danny tells her, well, you need to choose. Is it me or is it her? He put up with it for, I think it's a year and a half, 2 years, really a long time. that she was going through both of them every time she would go out of town and leave Danny behind for one reason or another to go see her. He was always very nice, but eventually just came to the point where he had to put the stop to it. And so the play is very much about how she makes that choice and about how her own hypocrisies come out with regards to her politics. The kind of defining character is played by Deirdre O'Connell, who is an aid worker in Africa and works a lot with really, really terrible situations over there and has her own very complex political views that in a way mirror Ellen's, but in a way don't, because they're much stronger and they're even more informed by real life rather than just philosophy. And the entire play is about that. And the problem with the play for me is just that Lisa Crone is a wonderful playwright. She really is, but she doesn't pull all the strings together to let sort of everything fall into place. I just thought that for the most part, it wasn't very interesting. There were some moments of setup that really made you think, okay, well, this is going to go somewhere, and you really expect that there are going to be fireworks and that there are going to be moments where you just sort of say, wow, okay, she finally gets it. This is going to change her. This is really going to make a big difference in someone's life on stage, and that doesn't happen. You can certainly make the case, and it's totally valid, that she is so wrapped up in herself that she couldn't really kind of go the final step and see how the way she treats people is not the way that she believes people should be treated. But Lisa Crone never really makes that case. She never goes all the way with it herself. So you just sort of, you're sort of ambling along, seeing them sort of dance around the central issue, but never go all the way with it. And again, that's valid dramatically, but I didn't personally find it very electrifying. I want to see characters who grow and change and develop. And a couple of the characters sort of do, but they're all sort of on the outside. There's Danny's sister and her partner slash wife who have their own kind of political feelings that don't always jibe with Ellen's. And they want their own sort of professional lives that aren't always going to be in line with what other people want. And it just sort of all tumbles together and then tumbles away and doesn't really add up to much of anything. And I think that's too bad, because I think that if you do something like this and it doesn't sort of coalesce into a final ball, then you haven't really done anything. And that's why Well was so great, is because Well was this sort of grouping of two or three really different and really weird plot threads and ideas. But by the end, Lisa Crone had kind of compressed them all together and made them into a single story. And then you were able to look at it and say, okay, yeah, I see why she was going there and why she did that. And that doesn't happen here. The director is the same, Lee Silverman, and direction is fine. The staging is fine. The set, just by David Korins, is very nice. It's kind of a combination of a messy East Village walk-up and just sort of modern touches around the edges, and there's nothing really wrong with the play. I just kept hoping for something more than I got from it, and I think that you can only go so far just throwing out ideas before you really need to make them pay off. And for me, the payoff in the wake is what was left in the wake.
I liked it substantially more, and I do think it comes to a tremendous boil at the end of the play, because what happens is that Judy, this person who's done all this work overseas, this charitable work dealing with the terribly underprivileged people of the world, has a phenomenal speech in which she talks about why she does not vote. Now, she's been very good friends with Ellen Marin Ireland for a long time, and Ellen is astonished to hear that this good friend of hers doesn't vote. She's appalled by it. And we understand that. Those of us who vote know how important it is. I'll do a little sidebar here to talk about a show called Vote With Me that I saw a few weeks ago, which dealt with the fact that many Americans don't vote. And what they did was actually have a song where they listed all the countries that have a better rate of voting than we do. And we had to hear 138 countries before the United States was mentioned. So it was fascinating also on election week when I saw the play to see this play dealing with, really, is there any point to voting? And what's wonderful is that Judy comes up with very good reasons why it's pointless. I am not suggesting remotely that we should all stop voting. But what I am saying is that Lisa Crone really did her work in coming up with reasons that sound valid, why there's no use in it, that nothing is going to change, that the more things change, you know what I'm going to say. So that was, to me, a very powerful thing after this whole play has been dealing with political issues. It's also fascinating to me to see the Bush presidency distilled in a play. We do go through the entire 8 years. The play starts with whether or not it's going to be Gore or Bush in the 2000 election, and to go through that and Hurricane Katrina and so on and so forth is arresting to me to see it distilled, and I thought she did a fabulous job of it. So I like the play substantially more, and I also think that Marin Island is giving one of the most dynamic performances of the season in playing this person who is just outraged by everything that happens in the political world, that she almost takes it personally. So that's pretty fascinating as well. Also, the scene where she meets the woman who will become her girlfriend is wonderfully set up because she doesn't see it coming. I do think we do. I certainly did, the way the woman was interacting with her very subtly, but nevertheless putting out little feelers, either through telepathy or well-placed words in terms of indicating what she really wanted from Ellen, that she did want a physical relationship. So I also thought that Michael Chernus was excellent as Danny, as this man who is caught between finding himself as the old, as Matthew says, maybe common law husband, if they still use that term, and this new relationship that Ellen is having, that is one that he doesn't quite understand. I thought the way he handled it was really a textbook example of how people should handle it under these situations, being as indulgent as you can while hoping that it's going to play itself out, because you really do love the person you're with. So all these things made for me a fascinating evening, and one that really had me hanging on every word. So I can recommend In the Wake substantially more enthusiastically than Matthew can. So I guess the answer is for you to go to see it and see if you're more on his side or mine.
I agree about the acting, by the way. I mean, Marin Ireland is really terrific. I think she's terrific in general, really.
Yeah, she really
but
is.
Really, I mean, it's a nice collection of kind of personality performers, and they're all doing perfectly fine work. I guess regarding Michael Chernus and Deirdre O'Connell, though, I as much as I like them, I feel like I always see them give very, very similar performances. And with Marin Ireland, yeah, she has a certain type and a certain style, but every time I see her, she always seems different. She seemed very different here than she did in Reasons to Be Pretty, and
I agree.
Very different in Reasons to Be Pretty than she has in a number of other plays I've seen her in. She seems to me a little bit better about sort of modulating her Marin Ireland-ness than some of the actors do. But they're experts. They're all experts at what they're doing on stage, so that certainly helps.
Well, the other thing, too, is here's where it comes into play, Matthew, that you see most everything that's out there. And as a result, you can be less impressed by Deirdre O'Connell and Michael Chernus because you've seen them so many times. But I dare say that most of the people who are listening to us or the average theater goer hasn't. And as a result, I think that even if one can even suggest that they have their tricks or their shtick or anything like that. The point is, if it's new to these people, I think they're going to be impressed seeing these people for the first time. And this may just be a good example of typecasting, too. It could very well be that. But nevertheless, whatever came before or whatever will come after, these are very good performances.
Let's move on to some news of the day. New York City and Broadway has been abuzz about Spider-Man all this week since Mr. Riedel teased us last week about impending problems, and it seems that it is Mr. Riedel has been once again correct with his sources that they did have some injuries at Spider-Man, and they did push the opening date back and the preview dates. And so, Peter, Matthew, what do you make of this? Is it Is it good to be opening up a show in January, a $60 million show?
Well, I don't know about opening a $60 million show any time of the year, of course.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and I don't know if it would make any difference when you open Spider-Man. I'm getting the feeling it's not going to help no matter what.
But now I'm wondering if, given the fact that there has been so much negative publicity about Spider-Man, if it's going to turn the other way, in the sense the critics are going to go expecting far less, and as a result, maybe more indulgent, because there have been so many predictions of doom and gloom about this show. More than a year delay, the injuries, the producers pulling out, having to raise more money in a hurry. I had heard the budget was 45 all the time, and now we're hearing 60, you know. So I have a feeling that it could benefit in a strange type of
I think they're getting all their negative PR right out of the way. I mean, yeah, you still have a few months before it opens.
Yeah, so it may work in its favor. I'm going to go to a case that took place 45 years ago, which was a musical called Skyscraper. And Skyscraper was written by Conrad Van Usen, who had written a lot of pop songs for Frank Sinatra, The Tender Trap, All the Way, a lot of wonderful songs. And they had written this musical. And what had happened was that the Michael Riedel of her day, Dorothy Kilgallen, went to see it at a preview. And reported on it while it was in previews that she didn't think it was much good. And it became a firestorm. Now, in those days, this just wasn't done at all. I mean, today we think, my God, the word of mouth on previews, everybody knows what it is because of the internet and all the people who post. But nevertheless, in those days, this wasn't the case. And it was just not the thing to do. And as a result, it became such an incredible brouhaha that when the show opened, the critics went and were rather indulgent towards Skyscraper. It wasn't a good show, but they got reasonably good reviews for a show that many people think would have gotten rotten reviews had the Kilgallen thing not happened. So it's not impossible that a similar thing will happen with Spider-Man, that because of all this negative publicity, people are going to say, oh, my God, this is just going to be a disgrace. Oh, this is going to be terrible. And then, well, you know, not so bad. You know, and they'll find some ways of making it better than it is. Not impossible.
One of the things that I found interesting was that I read that they had a $6 million advance and people were like, oh, that's so little. And I think every show other than Wicked out there would kill for a $6 million advance.
But they don't have $60 million budget.
No, absolutely.
You know, that's the problem.
But I mean, they're not even in previews yet.
No, I understand.
They're not even in previews yet. And I think that's interesting that I guess the scale of the thing does make it dangerous for not having a quarter of your advance in the bank yet.
I was just going to say that a lot of the issues about Spider-Man don't seem to be related to the quality of the show itself. No, I'm serious. We don't seem to know very much at all about the writing yet. So this seems to me like it might be a little bit different from Skyscraper. I mean, what we're hearing are huge mismanagement issues behind the scene. Of course, we know about the huge budget. And now lately, just within the last couple of weeks, we've gotten word about two different actors suffering serious, not life-threatening, but serious injuries, sure, as a result of all of the flying in the show. And that, to me, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a bad show, but it means like it seems to me like it could mean it's a dangerous one and one that could take them a long time to get exactly right. And it seems I don't know if it's a good idea of having that kind of stuff going on if in rehearsals the actors are getting injured like that. I guess they don't want it to be a flying by Foy kind of Mary Martin in Peter Pan kind of thing. And I understand that, but I don't know. The injuries are kind of what bothers me most. I from what they're saying, it's people swinging and flying over the heads of the audience all the time. And I'm sure that'll be really exciting, but it's gotta be impossible to work out pretty much. I don't know what technology they're using, but That to me seems like it's one of the main worries right now. And it was just announced a couple of days ago. I think that I just read something yesterday, as a matter of fact, that they're talking about bringing in a co-star for Reeve Carney, or I'm sorry, a substitute who would do it a couple of days a week. Is it because the show is vocally demanding, which is usually why that happens? Or is it because it's physically demanding? Or did Reeve Carney just say, listen, I'm going to risk my life doing these acrobatics six times a week, and that's – I don't know. But there's so much weird stuff going on with the show. I feel like, you know, Michael Riedel has been doing his usual due diligence, but I still feel like we haven't heard all of the story yet.
You know, the interesting part is that it seems like it's coming strictly through Michael Riedel, and because I'm not hearing the typical other types of leaks that cast members or various other folks that are associated with the production might be in touch with me or some of the other websites that are out there that would report this stuff. It also seems like Michael has taken this on as his personal pet project that's going to maybe get him through sweeps week or ratings or whatever.
Well, I mean, of course, that's what he does. he did it with Bernadette Peters and Gypsy.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He goes where the stories are, and there have been a year's worth of stories out of Spider-Man already.
Sure.
And so do you see this this Matthew James Thomas as being like a Billy Elliot alternate, like some will do half the week, the other do the half the week? Or
I think it says in the story that he might play it twice a week, but this hasn't been officially announced yet. It came from a story.
Peter, what other types of famous six and twos? I think Patti LuPone did that in Evita, didn't she?
Yeah, Lea Salonga too.
Lea did that in Saigon.
Yeah, she did.
Christine and Phantom of the Opera has always been six.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know, as a result, I think that there should be Tony Awards for these people. I mean, after all, there are daytime Emmys, aren't there? So maybe there should be daytime Tonys for these people who come in and do these shows.
Well, the most recent example of this that I can think of was actually in Fella, where the lead actor, Sar Ngawa, played it five times a week. They had the alternate, Kevin Mambo, played it three times a week. And recently, this first time I've ever heard of this happening, Sar Ngawa left the cast and Kevin Mambo took it over eight times a week. So he's performing more performances now than Sar Ngawa did. And I don't know what that means. I don't know what, if anything, we're supposed to read into that. But the whole thing with alternates is always very strange. There don't always seem to be a lot of rules regarding what happens. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised one way or another.
I was pretty surprised that it never occurred to me that some sort of jurisdictional or governmental organization would come in and check to see your show was safe before you actually performed it. Have you ever heard of that before?
No, only with theaters, but not certainly with productions. It may very well have happened, but I certainly haven't heard of it. I guess that there's probably some of that when there's flying involved in any show, at least perfunctory type of examination, but not to this degree, but it does seem as if it's warranted. And, you know, really, all it takes is one accident from somebody flying in over an audience's head to fall and really hurt a number of theater goers, and that's going to be that. So we really have to worry about Spider-Man in that regard, whether or not it's really going to cause injuries to theater goers. And I'm particularly worried about that.
Any truth to the rumor that they might just try to drop him on Michael Riedel? They have spotters at the doors when he comes in.
If he doesn't go to that theater with at least an umbrella, or if he doesn't insist to be seated under the mezzanine overhang, you know, he deserves whatever happens to him. I think he's a lot smarter than that person.
Can you imagine the party that would happen if that had happened? I mean, I can just see so many people on Broadway getting together and singing Happy Days Are Here Again, you know. So anyway,
speaking of Happy Days Are Here Again.
Yes.
Rent is reopening off Broadway next year. And knowing fully well how Matthew feels about revivals, Peter, we'll have you start with your opinion on Rent reopening off-Broadway.
What I would love to have happened is for Rent to return to where it began at the New York Theatre Workshop in the East Village. I think that would really be exciting and nice. They're going to New World Stages, a rather antiseptic group of theaters. And what I would like to see happen is that New York Theatre Workshop move its productions for a season or however long Rent lasts to New World Stages and do their work there. Because having it happen where it began would have been really, really effective. There's no question that there's an audience for Rent, and people will go to New World Stages and have a perfectly decent time, and that's fine. And we'll be nice to see it in a smaller space so we can at least imagine what it was like when it started off Broadway. But I would be more intrigued if it went back to where it started. When Chorus Line, the original production of Chorus Line, was closing, there was some noise about, why don't we take it back to the Newman where it began? That was at least discussed. I don't know how far the discussions got, but that definitely was on the table as part of the plan to discuss. And that would have been fun, too, to see it back then because so few people did because it was such a hot ticket. So welcome back, Rent. It'll be interesting to see if there are enough of an audience to go. I would think there would be in an off-Broadway house. I don't know if it'll cause the same type of sensation. A lot of Rent is understandably dated. It wasn't long into the run that it was happily dated. There's a lyric about AZT, and I was delighted when I saw Rent about a year or two into the run, thinking this is already dated, let alone, of course, with the at the end of the millennium lyric. But I think Rent's a very good show, and I like it immeasurably. So I'm going to be interested to see it again.
Well, I like Rent, and I think that as long as we have Avenue Q and the 39 Steps there, it doesn't hurt anything to bring it back. Ever since it opened, New World Stages has been having trouble keeping tenants there for very long. Altar Boys is really the exception rather than the rule, and that Gazillion Bubble show has been there for a couple of years, and that also is very rare. So as long as those theaters aren't being used by something else, I guess it's okay. I just it's going to be staged by Michael Greif again. It's going to be the same show that we've seen just after a 3-year hiatus. I might not mind a new take on it. There'll certainly be new people in it, and probably we've never seen before. Probably many of them making their New York debut, and that's great. But it's just going to be the same old Rent, and I wouldn't mind seeing a new version of it. Something that just sort of changes what we knew about it, or a new director, just bringing a new eye to the story. I don't think that would be a bad thing, but I like Rent. It's a good show. There's a lot of really good stuff in it. It's certainly very powerful, and that's
sure. But there are a lot of people who didn't see the way it looked originally. Even though you say it's only been 3 years, there are certainly people who became theatergoers in the last 3 years who weren't theatergoers before. I'm talking about young kids who are just learning there's such a thing as musical theater. I'm reminded of in 1986 when I went to Wagner College to see a production of Chicago, and I was astonished that it was exactly down to the quarter inch of blocking, the same production I had seen in 1975 on Broadway. And I learned that the gentleman who was directing out there used to go to Broadway shows endlessly with a little yellow pad and take down every piece of blocking and replicate it tremendously. And I said, wow, I am coming out here now every time there's a musical I never saw originally, because I will see the original staging. And that was important to me, you know, to see it exactly the way it was originally. As a result, there have got to be people who are having that experience with Rent, that they missed it. And now they'll have the chance to see exactly the way it looked. And I think that would be of value to a lot of people.
But they can get the DVD of the final performance and see exactly the way it looked.
Well, I am actually very in agreement with you guys. I'm really excited to see Rent back. I think it's a very good show. I think there's a lot of energy to it. You've brought up all the points that I was going to bring up, so I'm not going to rehash it about a good introduction for new actors to New York and lots of other things. And I wish it well. I think it's a brilliant idea. I saw the headline and I went, oh, But very, very smart. So talking about old things becoming new again, Porgy and Bess coming back as a musical. Peter, have you had any experience with Porgy and Bess?
Sure. The very famous revival that took place in, I saw it in 76. I think it, I saw it in Philadelphia in its pre-Broadway tryout, so to speak, before it came into town. So I don't remember if it opened in 76 or 77 here, but it it was one of the first, if not the first, production to get a revival Tony. The award was either just starting or damn close to it. So so I remember that very vividly in Philadelphia. It was a tremendous experience. And yes, it is an opera. There's no question about it. That's what George Gershwin wanted, and that's what he had. So it we sometimes think of it as a musical theater piece because so many of its songs seem to be musical theater songs, especially Sport and Life songs, which are very much in the musical comedy tradition. But nevertheless, it is an opera, and now we're getting Susan Laurie Parks to adapt it into a musical. I'm wary of this, but nevertheless, I'll give her the benefit of the doubt and see if she comes up with anything interesting. But what's so interesting to me, by the way, is the fact that the Gershwin estate has been very, very protective about Porgy and Bess. And it's very scintillating to me that now that they've said, okay, go ahead. I wouldn't have expected this to happen, I have to say, considering how exacting they've been with Porgy and Bess in the past. But
Peter, yeah. Can I interrupt you for a second? I'm not sure. I don't have my facts here. Is it possible that Porgy and Bess is going into public domain soon and they need to do something to extend that?
Ah, no idea. No
because
idea.
Because I wonder if Porgy and Bess is going into the public domain, then they'd lose control of it. So a new production would extend the... at least for the musical aspect of it, would extend out the copyright another 75 years plus whatever, which is a possibility. And I know it's something that the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization is you know, not excited about, you know, Carousel Oklahoma and the other properties heading into public domain sometime soon. I wonder if...
What a great theory. I wouldn't be surprised if you're 100% correct. That would explain a lot.
I'm sorry I interrupted you, but it just...
No, I'm done. I want to hear what Matthew
has to say. Okay, Matthew, what do you have to say?
I know that Trevor Nunn had an idea to do something similar to this in London a while back. I actually don't know anyone who saw it or really had any comments about it. But I know he tried to do that. He just changed a lot of the recitative to dialogue and just kept the big numbers. And I don't see the point personally. I think that if you really just want to approach it as a play, you might as well just do the original Porgy and be done with it. And if you strip away all of the stuff that makes it operatic, is it still Porgy and Bess? I don't know. I think that second guessing the composer and the lyricist of any project is usually not a smart idea. I understand James's point about it going into the public domain, and certainly they want to probably create something that can be done by people who aren't really experienced and trained opera singers. But is it necessarily going to be better than the original? Is it going to be as good as the original? I don't see how, really. I'm not the world's hugest Susan Laurie Parks fan. I don't think it needs to be made contemporary or adjusted for modern audiences the way they're talking about. I don't see what's wrong with it as it exists. I don't see what could be done to it that's going to maintain the integrity of it as a dramatic work. I would love to be proven wrong. It certainly is possible Diane Paulus, who's going to be directing it at the American Repertory Theater up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Of course, she's a good talent. And I'm not a huge Susan Laurie Parks fan, but she has a lot of experience as a playwright. So it's not... They don't have bad people working on it, but I don't see what the artistic goal is. And without that, I just don't see really what all is going to come of this. But I am assuming we will see it in New York soon enough. So I guess we'll all have our chance to find out.
I guess that's we'll have to see what we come up with Porgy and Bess and see if it was if it's worth it. I'm supposing that the underlying material is something that would be interesting to a Broadway audience, and we'll have to see. Did they have a time frame on this, when it was going to when they were going to plan to debut it?
Not that I saw.
September 2011.
All right, so we have about a year or so, which really is no time whatsoever. It'll be here before we know it. Speaking of being here before we know it, Roger Rees is replacing Nathan Lane in the Addams Family. There was lots of rumors about who was going to replace Nathan, and is Nathan replaceable in this role? Is this show going to close? And I saw this and I said, oh, Roger Rees, that's going to be very, very, very much fun and very interesting. What do you guys think about Roger doing this?
Well, I like Roger Rees, but I would certainly never have considered him as a replacement for Nathan Lane. I think he's probably best known for Cheers, which has been off the air for quite a while. And of course, he has done his fair share of artistic directing and stage acting as well. I also have no idea how or if he'll bring in the audiences. I would like to believe he would. I mean, he's very talented, but that's not always enough. So they might be counting on Bebe Neuwirth to carry the box office. And I believe that she's sticking around. I don't think she's leaving when Nathan Lane is. So this seems like a really weird choice to me, but it could work out. I don't know. Time will tell.
Well, as one of the 12 most ignorant people on the planet where it comes to television, because I'm always at the theater, and as someone who has never seen an episode of Cheers, my question is, do they have much to do with each other on the show?
Not really. Roger Rees was brought in as a love interest for Kirstie Alley in the last several years of the show's run. I don't recall there being any interplay between those two characters at all.
No,
I mean, of course, they're counting on the double Cheers connection as some sort of a selling point, but it's not like Bebe Neuwirth and Kelsey Grammer were doing a show together or something like that. So,
Neil, do you guys consider that Morticia role like the Grisabella of the 2000s? You know, you have 15 minutes on stage per night and you come out and you do your big number.
Yeah, I'm surprised that Morticia doesn't have more to do in the show, and I think it may have been a mistake not to have her do
more.
Well,
that was big on the reviews, yeah.
And especially now. But I would have expected somebody far more famous to the average person than Roger Rees going into this part. Now, I know, of course, that he has a connection with the co-book writer, Rick Elise, that said, it almost strikes me that he's doing his beau a favor by going into it more than the fact that this is going to set the box office aflame. So it seems to me that the same mistake is being made with that other famous Nathan Lane musical, The Producers, that you're not getting people of a similar stripe to come in and take over. So I don't think it's a good idea in that sense. But yeah, the thing that Matthew was saying about Cheers has been off the air a long time. One thing I guess we have to remember now is all these things are available on DVD and maybe have audiences as a result of that. Again, this would have meant a lot more if indeed Bebe Neuwirth and Roger Rees had a real relationship in the Cheers series. It's funny that you mentioned Kelsey Grammer, because I could certainly see him as Gomez, and yeah. that would have been a very interesting choice.
You know, it just occurred to me, and I should have remembered this earlier, but Roger Rees did star in A Man of No Importance off Broadway. And now that I'm thinking, it was not one of my personal favorite Ahrens and Flaherty musicals of all time. But I mean, now that I'm thinking back about it on it, he probably did a fair amount of talk singing in that show. I don't recall. I mean, he's obviously not a serious vocalist of any sort, but he does have at least a slight musical theater connection in that way. But there he was certainly being hired more for his acting and for his accent and his kind of sense of believability as a UK person facing, you know, issues of homosexuality and all that. So seems to me there's a little bit more verisimilitude there than there necessarily would be with the Addams Family. But certainly Roger Rees is good at dark kind of comedy, and that's a lot of what the Addams Family aspires to. But in terms of the singing, it's not, he's not Nathan Lane, that's for sure.
That wasn't his first musical either, although he didn't make it to opening night, and I don't know if he was fired or if he was quit, but way back in 1993, he was in the final Julie Stein musical, The Red Shoes.
I had forgotten about that, you're right.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Peter, I don't know the musical version of that at all. How much did that character sing?
Not a lot, to be fair. Yeah. So Steve Barton took over for him. So I didn't see Roger Rees because I only saw it after it opened, meaning just before it closed. So, but I don't recall that character singing very much at all. I may be wrong about that, but that's not my recollection. I definitely recall that character close to center stage three times singing songs. There may be more than that, but that's what I recall. But because I definitely remember that one of the songs was a song that Julie Stein tried to recycle so many times, originally written for Look to the Lilies, I think, back in 1970. So I remember that very well. But I much of the time, I believe he was part of numbers as opposed to having big solos of his own.
Peter, were you, I know you mentioned that you don't get to see any, you don't get to see much television, but did you see, were you a fan of The West Wing?
Never saw that either.
Never saw that.
Really, I mean, are some years I go to the theater 365 times. So, and while I could TiVo and all that kind of business,
when would you sleep?
So I mean, I do watch movies when I get in bed at night, you know, a DVD, but usually after 10 minutes I'm asleep. So every movie becomes a mini series for me, 10 minutes in a night, and then it's over. So, all this writing takes its toll. So
Roger did a guest starring role in a recurring guest starring role in The West Wing, Aaron Sorkin's television drama about Washington, D.C. and the presidency. And he was very, very good in it. And he had a lot of fans in it in that role as well. So maybe there'll be a little carryover there.
Oh, I hope so.
West Wing's been off the air a number of years as well. So,
yeah. But nobody's going to be surprised if the Addams Family closes very quickly. I mean, in a way, this seems like the strangest cast replacement since Danielle Derriere took over for Coco, for Katharine Hepburn. So it almost seems to be that type of magnitude. So we shall see what we shall see.
All right. Next on our agenda, we have Mary Zimmerman is writing a new book for Candide in Chicago. And Matthew, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know what there really is to tell about this. You kind of said it all. Mary Zimmerman, who is best known in New York for doing Metamorphoses, which was the Ovid adaptation that sort of coincided with the September 11th attacks. And really, it, to my mind at least, it kind of benefited a little bit from that because it really captured the sort of mood of the city at that point. And I mean, there was a beautiful play, but she's really well known as a director and someone who conceives works from the ground up. And of course, with Candide, that's exactly the opposite. She is coming up, she is doing a new book, which is in performances now, as far as I understand, for the show. And Charles Isherwood reviewed it on a recent trip to Chicago. And again, it's like at least the 9,671st book for Candide. And I think that my personal opinion from having seen only like three or four of them is that really they need to give it up. I don't know that you're ever going to be able to have a book for Candide that quote unquote works, because really at this point, the show's been through so many iterations and so many dozens of authors of the book and the lyrics and so many dozens of variations of in combinations of the Leonard Bernstein songs. No one knows what it's supposed to be anymore. No one knows how to get it back to whatever the original was, assuming they even want to do that, because of course the original production didn't run very long either. I don't even think it ran 2 months. Anyway, I think the best thing to be done for a book for Candide at this point is just to beg and plead with the Lillian Hellman estate to release her original libretto that's just been locked up and locked away for, I guess, decades now. I don't even know how long. I'm not saying it's a great book. I read it once a number of years ago. I'm afraid I don't remember a lot of the details about it, but at least the songs were written to go with that libretto, and we'll be able to see, or at least get an idea of what the writers and the original director were going for with the show. Because I just feel like at this point, Leonard Bernstein has been dead for so long. He's probably still writing songs for it, actually. I mean, he never stopped. That really, we've gotten just miles or light years away from whatever the original conception of the show was. And without that, I think we're just going to keep finding different versions of Candide that people come up with that don't work. And every review always says basically the same thing, you know, oh, the songs are fantastic, oh, the dialogue, the book, et cetera. And certainly every production of Candide I've seen has had that problem with it. Probably the most successful of all the Candides I've seen has been the much, let's face it, the much reviled Alani Price concert at the Philharmonic in 2004, which worked, I think, specifically because they just didn't do 95% of the book. And the more of the book you do, the more you're forced to realize that the pieces don't fit together properly. So when that concert just focused on the songs and having fun and just sort of very, very lightly suggesting the story, you were able to just sort of go along with it in a way you can't when you're bogged down with long dialogue scenes and tons of characters you can't follow. I mean, Candide is a really tough show, and I don't think there's any way around that no matter what you do, but I don't know what good a new book is going to do. Now, in fairness, of course, I haven't seen this. I have no idea if this will come to New York after Charles Isherwood's review. I wouldn't count on it, actually. But it's really just an impossible situation. And certainly they think that the music has worth because they keep going at it. But I just don't know if there's ever any way to make it work as an actual show. I mean, I'd love to be wrong about that. But so many people with such big names have tried and failed over the last 5.5 decades. I don't think that one more book for Candide is really going to make a difference. But maybe. I mean, who knows?
I can't say that I imagine it's going to make much of a difference either. However, Mary Zimmerman is certainly a tremendous artist, and her work on Arabian Nights and Metamorphosis and so many others is certainly eye-appealing and arresting. So I would never underestimate her. She got a MacArthur grant and I think deserves it. And I remember one time I was talking to her and she was talking about teaching at, I believe, Northwestern she teaches. And she was talking about how her students were beguiling. And I love that word. And she's pretty beguiling herself. So I wish her well in this project, but I don't know what could be done either. Matthew mentions Lonnie Price's concert version, which I liked immeasurably as well. I'll hearken back to the 1974 production that was done at the Broadway Theater where Promises, Promises is now. And most of the people sat on stools and the characters weaved around them. And there were bleachers where the rest of us sat. I was in the bleachers. What made the show successful was the fact that it was using this environmental staging, which, by the way, did not seem new to me because I had been to a lot of regional theaters, especially Trinity Square, as it was called then in Providence. It used a lot of techniques, Harold Prince did, that I saw in many regional theater productions. And but it was new to Broadway, and as a result, this imagination, this less is more approach, this very theatricalized approach, certainly did Candide very well. And it ran for 2 years, and I think that's the most successful we'll ever see Candide. I also find it interesting that a book that was originally written by a woman is now coming back to be written by a woman after a detour by Hugh Wheeler's book. So the one thing that's also has to be said about Candide is, even though, yes, it was a quick failure and ran 2 months back in the 1956 and 57 season, is that it did get a Tony nomination as Best Musical. Now, that's pretty good for a show that runs 73 performances. On the other hand, let's look and see what else was playing that was eligible for a Tony that year. And now, by the way, the other nominees were My Fair Lady, no surprise, The Most Happy Fella, no surprise, and Bells Are Ringing, no surprise. However, there was another long-running show that could have got that fourth slot, and that was Little Abner, which did run almost 700 performances and was a very popular hit. The other shows, yes, all right, also ran. Happy Hunting ran a year, but that was because of Ethel Merman. And but the other ones really were pretty lousy shows. Mr. Wonderful was always considered a terrible show, and New Faces of 56 and Shangri-La, based on Lost Horizon, which ran 3 weeks. And so there wasn't much to choose from. Still, it's nice that the Tony committee was able to say, okay, Candide wasn't a hit. And supposedly, yes, Lillian Hellman's book has always been accused of being laborious. Yes, like Matthew, I've never seen it. So, but still, the Tony committee gets credit for putting that ahead of Little Abner, which would have been certainly an understandable choice. So there obviously, even back then, when Candide had its problems, there were those who felt it had merit as a show, not just a score, but as a show. So, though we all know it's the score that's really kept it alive for all these years. So when I was growing up, the idea of seeing Candide was always so amazingly fetching to me. And I remember in 72, there was a production in Washington, and I desperately wanted to go, and I just couldn't. And I was heartbroken. Little did I know how much I would see Candide in the years to come, because that 74 production really did spur so many, many, many more productions, including a major Broadway revival in the late 90s. So I think Candide is something that's always going to be with us, problems and all.
So this week on Broadway, we've had quite a few passings that have saddened us all. We want to talk about a few of them. Jill Clayburgh passed away. Peter, can you say a few words about Jill?
I was seeing Jill Clayburgh when she was just starting out in Boston. She was at the Charles Playhouse, which had a repertory company at the time. And I first saw her do Awake and Sing, in which she played Henny. And it was very interesting because she was playing opposite this other actor just starting out named Al Pacino. So I dare say if I can put that playbill on eBay, I'm going to do very, very well. So it was wonderful to see this up-and-coming actress at that point. She also was tremendously entertaining in Oh, What a Lovely War, in a musical, so she could do musicals too. So I was always rooting for Jill Clayburgh, and I was, and then suddenly she wasn't at the Charles Playhouse anymore, and I lost track of her. And then all of a sudden, here comes that Unmarried Woman movie, and she's a big movie star for a while. And I couldn't have been more happy, because I had seen her really all those times coming out of the theater saying, you know, this Jill Clayburgh lady is really good. Yeah, but never expecting that this local Boston actress would turn out to have this very illustrious career as time went on, and really for a while there, one of Hollywood's go-to actresses and even a household name. So last year at New World Stages at some party, I don't remember for what, we had a nice talk about those days, and she was really glad to be reminded of them and happy to know that somebody saw them and remembered them. And it was just a lovely experience. I didn't know she was sick. I mean, we all knew that something was either happening with her or David Rabe this week when Lily Rabe had to leave Merchant of Venice. And I think most of us inferred that the reason was that one of her parents was ill. So I'm very sad to see this happen, especially I had no idea that she was only 2 years older than I. I mean, as a result, I even have more respect for what she was doing when I was 20 and 21 years old. Seeing her, that she was only 22 and 23, really surprises me.
I never met her, but I have seen her on stage a number of times on Broadway in Barefoot in the Park and A Naked Girl on the Appian Way, and off Broadway in The Clean House and The Busy World Is Hushed. And She's a very good actress. She could be very funny, and had a very nice onstage presence. I don't really know what else to say about it than that. But I think it's always nice when someone who goes off and has a really good career in Hollywood and doing movies and television comes back. And you know, just over the last 5 years, she's had some major theater credits, and I think that she was probably going to have some more in the years to come. And it's nice to have someone come back and bestow their talent on us again after you think that they've gone for good. So it's certainly too bad, and I feel bad, but certainly Lily Rabe is you know, an excellent actress too. So it's obvious where she got it from, basically. But yeah, it's too bad. But I'm glad I got to see her, even in the very few times that I did.
All right. Also passing away this week, we talked last week about Joseph Stein passing away, and ironically, another member of the group there, Jerry Bock, passed away. Peter, why don't you talk about that?
I have two stories about Jerry Bock that I think are more than moderate interest. I always have one of those day-by-day calendars where you pull off the page each day like they do in 1776. Mm-hmm. And one year I had one that had word definitions. And one of the word definitions was for a word, sabulous, S-A-B-U-L-O-U-S. And it means gritty, sandy, like if you get a seafood dish and there's still some sand in it, you know, like clams or something like that, you would say that it's sabulous. And I wrote and saying in a column saying, this is something, a word that should be used much more. Because if it is, lyricists will have a word to rhyme with fabulous. Yeah, and it will really help lyricists. So everybody start using the word sabulous. And one day I was home and the phone rang and, hi, this is Jerry Bock. I just saw your notation on the word sabulous, and I thought that was the funniest thing ever, and I just wanted to call and tell you. Now, really, I mean, how about that? All right, a better story, perhaps, involves my friend Larry Feinberg, who in 1970 was producing a play called Early Morning at La Mama. Early Morning was written by Edward Bond. In it, Queen Victoria and Florence Nightingale were having a lesbian relationship. Queen Victoria's two sons were Siamese twins. And Queen Victoria decided maybe it'd be good if one of the twins got married to Florence Nightingale to keep her in the family. So there's the scene where one of the twins is courting Florence Nightingale, which makes the other twins say, warn me if you're going to kneel. You know, I mean, so it was a crazy, crazy play. And Larry wrote me the other day and said, you know, I got a lot of the money from that play from Jerry Bock. And who would expect that a mainstream Broadway composer, all right, yes, there's no question his shows are ambitious, but nevertheless, a mainstream Broadway composer would be so enthusiastic about such an off-the-wall play down at La Mama that it would even be on his radar that he'd be willing to write a check. So as a result, this man really was extraordinary. I am so sorry, of course, that he and Sheldon Harnick broke up 40 years ago. And I remember speaking to both of them on two occasions. One was a phone interview I was doing when there was a revival of the Rothschilds, and Sheldon did tell me that, yes, it was the story we've always heard, that they disagreed over the direction of the Rothschilds, that Sheldon wanted the director, Derek Oldby, replaced, while Jerry did not. And when I asked Jerry Bock about it, I said, will you comment on this? And he said, no. But I always got the impression each of them was waiting for the other to make the phone call and say, ah, come on. In the 90s, when She Loves Me was revived, Lincoln Center asked me to come and do a panel discussion with all three collaborators of She Loves Me, including Joe Masteroff. They were taping it. It's at Lincoln Center. You can see it anytime you want. And I was really paying attention for what happened when Sheldon arrived first. So what would happen when Jerry came in the room? And there was such a sense of regret in the way each of them said hello to each other. I mean, it's so sad that this happened, because think of how many wonderful shows we would have had. They did 7 and 12 years. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't have done as many because production doesn't happen as readily as it used to. But still, we would have had so many more Bock and Harnick shows, and that would have been all to the good, because they were a marvelous team. But obviously, as well as a wonderful composer, and I even like the scores that are considered minor scores, such as Tenderloin, which I think is really marvelous. He obviously was a terrific human being as well. So I'm sorry that he's gone. And, you know, the thing also is that while he was alive, there was always a chance, however slight, that maybe he and Sheldrick would write another show. They did write one more song, of course, for the recent Fiddler revival. But nevertheless, there was always that chance. And now that chance is gone forever. And that's sad.
I loved his scores. I mean, he wrote wonderful music. And it's always, I guess the thing about artists in general, and all kinds of artists, whether they're writers or actors or designers or whatever, is that they love doing different kinds of things. And certainly the realm of Bach and Harnack shows just really runs every imaginable gamut. I mean, Fiorello is such a completely different show from She Loves Me, which is miles removed from Fiddler on the Roof, which doesn't sound anything like the first act of The Apple Tree, which doesn't sound anything like the second act of The Apple Tree, which doesn't sound anything like the third act of The Apple Tree. And just to know that he was able to write so many different styles of music so completely convincingly, and with Sheldon Harnack with such a grip on the drama and, when necessary, the comedy of a situation, it's really great. I certainly don't know his catalog as well as Peter does, of course. I don't know all of his shows, but the ones I do know are just wonderful. I love listening to She Loves Me, and Fiddler on the Roof is a one-of-a-kind score, and I think Apple Tree is unjustly forgotten, or at least treated as a secondhand show. As I think the revival of a couple of years ago with Kristen Chenoweth pointed out, he was really a remarkable, one-of-a-kind, chameleonic talent that you certainly don't see anymore, and that even back then you didn't really see. There were a lot of composers write different kinds of shows, but they always kind of sound the same. I mean, they always sound like they're coming from the same person. That's not a bad thing, but that's what it is. And for me, his scores sounded like they came from 20 different people, but they all had the same integrity and talent behind them, and that's what matters. So yeah, I agree that it's really too bad we'll never see another show. We certainly wish there had been a good dozen or so more shows that they could have gone out on. But even so, to have the ones that we have is a wonderful gift, and I am glad that Jerry Bock was around to give it to us.
So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below that, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there is a new episode of our podcast, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. You can also subscribe to us in the Zune Marketplace or through Stitcher Radio, which is an application that runs on your iPhone or Android or BlackBerry or various other devices. Or you can listen to us three times a week on Broadway World Radio. If you have something that you would like to comment on or get in touch with us about, on the right-hand side of the Broadway Stars pages, there's a feedback form where you can send us an email. You could also give us a call at 646-873-7695 and leave us a voicemail. And if you do, we might play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you, please call.